to the Infrastructure Show. I'm your host, Professor Joseph Schoffer of Northwestern University. The Infrastructure Show is designed to present to listeners the reality of America's infrastructure, its condition, why it is the way it is, and what can be done about it. Houston is the fourth largest city in the country, and it's home to the nation's largest refining and petrochemical complex. It sits in the path of what could be the next big hurricane. Can we protect it? Can we act in time? With us today is Wesley Highfield, who's assistant professor in the Department of Marine Sciences at Texas A&M University, and he'll help us understand some of these issues. Wesley, I'm really glad to talk to you this morning.
Great. I'm happy to be here, Joe. Thank you.
So can you give us a sense of what the storm risk is like for Galveston, for Houston, for that part of Texas?
Well, I would say the risk is really high. You have to remember that Galveston is a barrier island. It has always been a barrier island. It is still moving and shifting as a barrier island, albeit somewhat slowly. Like many coastal areas, it's low-lying. There's zero topography at all, even as you move inland. So there's Galveston Island to the west. There's Galveston Bay that is somewhat circular in shape. You move north and west, and you start to come into the city of Houston and the greater Houston region. So you're talking about somewhere around a little over 4 million people. Last census numbers I saw, probably going to overtake the Chicago area as the third largest metro in the United States. Fairly spread out, not a dense area, but that leads to its own problems in terms of impervious surfaces and natural infrastructure. In terms of flood mitigation, made some progress there, but probably not where the region could be.
And my understanding is the terrain in the whole region is very flat and swampy, so it increases the risk?
Yeah, flat, swampy, what we would call gumbo soils, so they don't drain very well. Similar in nature to New Orleans, not so much in a bowl, not the loss of elevation, but certainly no topography, poor draining soils, just nowhere to go, so to speak. Built on a swamp. I mean, the Houston-Galveston area is literally built on a swamp.
So what can you tell us about the experience with hurricane-driven storm surges in that area?
Well, the most recent example, of course, is 2008, Hurricane Ike. Ike was a huge storm size-wise. I mean, it took up most of Galveston Bay. Came ashore as a Category 2, which is somewhat deceiving. If you recall, Saffir-Simpson is based on wind speeds, and Ike was not much of a wind-driven event. It was primarily a surge-driven event. If you look at Ike, ironically, in terms of its Ike score, its score of kinetic energy, it was a huge storm. Pushed surge on Baller Peninsula, which is a little bit to the east. You saw some 16, 17-foot surges. When you get on the Galveston Island itself, you were looking at 8, 10 feet in some fairly populated areas, so it was destructive. That event pegged somewhere around $30 billion in damage. And of course, that's direct impacts. You're not looking at indirect business loss, employment lost, transfer of manufacturing or production somewhere else. So it was a big event. It was a really big event.
And this wasn't the first time. I mean, historically, this is something of similar scale has happened in the past.
Correct. In the Galveston area, you're looking at an average recurrence interval of about 15 years. Of course, historically, what we look at is the Great 1900 storm, which killed thousands upon thousands of people. That's when you saw the first of the true infrastructure being built on Galveston was the seawall. There was a wholesale raising of the island and about a 16-foot seawall built to protect a portion of the island. And thus far, it has performed pretty well. The damages during Hurricane Ike, the seawall performed well, but that surge, because it was so large, pushed into the bay, came around the back end of the island and washed over, if that makes sense.
It's sort of what happened in New Orleans, if I understand it correctly, that the water came from the other side.
Yeah, very, very similar to that.
So what are the options? So you have a wall there, and presumably it could be bigger. My understanding is that if I look further to the north and west, Houston seems to have some kind of a good record in terms of evacuation planning. But what's a good answer in this case?
Well, I don't think there's one good answer, and I think that's part of the dilemma. I think that's part of any problem like this. They are wicked problems, if you will, and I borrow that term. But there's political issues, there are engineering issues, there are perception issues around risk. So, you know, there's lots of different parts and pieces. One of the larger proposals that you'll see and that is being championed by people at a lot of levels, homeowners, municipalities, counties, larger nonprofit and trade groups is what's being billed as the Ike Dike. which is probably better described as a coastal spine. So borrowing from the Dutch, that would take the existing seawall and extend it to the southwest, covering up what's a man-made pass there, and also take it further to the east with the ability to completely close off Galveston Bay. So lots of different engineering ways to approach it, but typically as some type of closing gates, sliding gates, inflatable barriers. There's a lot of ways to do it. But that's the big proposal on the books now. It's at least being investigated.
You'd have to keep the channel open, my understanding, because the Port of Houston at least is a huge bulk product port.
Absolutely. You have to keep that navigation channel open, which is part of the reason that gates are being championed the way they are. In terms of risk, I mean, we've talked about risk to houses and risk to communities, but a large proportion of the refining capacity of the United States is also at risk. That includes not only the gasoline we use in our cars, but a large proportion of the jet fuel used for military, not to mention numerous other petrochemical and petroleum products that get refined and or created up there. So large. The ability for those kind of shutdowns to ripple through the economy, not only regionally, but nationally, and some might argue globally, given the right storm, could be huge. So keeping that navigation channel open is really important, but being able to close it when the time is right and stop that surge from pushing in would be a very critical way to approach this.
So the Maestlandt barrier that protects Port of Rotterdam is a closable barrier that's kept open essentially all the time to maintain shipping. I think you have a similar thing in St. Petersburg in Russia.
The Maestlandt is the pattern being followed now, and some of those proposals are on the books. They're certainly not cheap, and I think that's the problem to overcome in terms of perception, but I would also argue the cost-benefit ratios are there easily in direct damages, and when you consider indirect damages and ripples through the economy, those cost-benefit ratios get pretty high.
So are there competing alternatives that make reasonable sense in this case?
You know, I think there were some competing alternatives up front. There was some discussion about only protecting the north end of Galveston Bay, which in effect is only protecting petrochemical and only protecting larger industrial uses. By and large, that doesn't have a lot of support, I don't think, anymore. We're kind of starting to get into the more political side of this, which I try to stay out of as best I can. But I think the primary winner, if you will, is a coastal spine, which is a combination of closing gates, but also extending the seawall or some type of raised spine along the island. That would keep the island protected. That would keep those homes protected. It would keep all of the communities in Galveston Bay protected, and it would keep petrochemical protected. So the cost benefits are there for that. I will say that, and I said something about wicked problems earlier. I think that the decision makers and policy makers, if you will, have to be careful about saying this is the silver bullet. This is what we're going to do. You know, brush our hands off and walk away. I think that's probably a dangerous precedent to set. A barrier is never going to protect everything. There's always going to be some flooding. And as we saw a couple weeks ago, there's always going to be inland flooding too. There's going to be precipitation-based flooding. So marrying a large structural project with other non-structural approaches needs to be done. Those are things like land use controls, which in Texas we don't have a lot of. They are things like setbacks. They are things like elevating residential structures. We do that already for coastal reasons. We need to do more of that for inland too. There are plenty of other approaches that need to be married together. That's one thing that worries me, is seeing a silver bullet approach. Hey, we're all good. Step away. I think you to some extent saw a little of that in New Orleans. They spent several billions of dollars putting their gates together. You still see some elevation there that happened before all that was built, but by and large, I think some people are starting to step away from that. And those things need to be done in concert.
So let me take you back to the barrier idea. I mean, I understand your point that one has to be careful about saying this is going to solve all the problems because one needs a multi-component solution. But is there a regional consensus on the nature of the risk and the importance of taking some action to defend?
I believe that there is a consensus on the risk and that it needs to be done. The action part of that is a political question, and that's about building political will. I think we've made a lot of progress there. I think it's still in the minds of people. It's still in the media. Clearly, we're talking about it today. So I think that there is some momentum building behind doing that. But that takes, again, back to the wicked problem, that takes local government, that takes state government, more importantly, and it takes the federal government. There's lots of moving parts to that. When you involve the Corps of Engineers and things and start to have their requirements for large infrastructure projects, then things tend to move pretty slowly. I would point out that New Orleans did not have those same project requirements, which is why they got things built so quickly.
That's something I don't understand, but I'm curious about the obstacles and about the degree of consensus. And my interpretation of the issue with leadership is really comes down to, are people willing to take a lead on spending the money to do this?
And whose money?
Yeah.
It's easier to spend somebody else's money, right? Off the top of my head, I think that the core to state match, and you may know better than I, is something 50-50 or 75-25. In New Orleans, you saw nothing near that match. You saw the feds picking up the bulk of the bill for those infrastructure and gates, levees, et cetera.
Yeah.
The way the core process sits now is that, I think it would be 2021 until anything could actually be done. Because of the studies that are required and because of the allocation of federal dollars just for the study alone.
My presumption is that as a researcher and as an engineer that you have some sense of what it takes to do those studies. Does it really require that kind of a time frame to finish the studies and make a decision?
Through the federal process, it absolutely does. That doesn't mean that, other studies can't be done or haven't been done, but getting the federal money behind it without some political help requires that long-term core process.
Yeah, and part of political help, I guess, is understanding what the risks is and what the options are, and as you'd say, the relationship between benefits and costs. And it sounds like there's a knowledge base to work off of, and is it a matter of communicating that to the right people?
Absolutely. And I think some of that is starting to be better communicated now. The consensus is certainly there around risks. The risks are quantifiable and not good. That would be a way to put that. Communicating that to decision makers, policy makers can be difficult. I mean, communicating risk to most people can be difficult. If I go on a random knock of my neighborhood and ask them what a 100-year flood means, most of them are going to say, that storm only happens every 100 years. Even getting over that hurdle with people can be difficult.
Yeah, I think we've gotten ourselves into trouble by talking about the 100-year flood, and we'll never get away from that. Do you see the possibility that there's some green options out there to provide some protection for the region?
I think that needs to be part of the larger plan. Yes, I do not believe in it, and I come from a field and an area that prioritizes green infrastructure and green approaches. So it's taken me a little time to come around, quite frankly. But I do believe something structural, something engineered, has to be done. That doesn't mean that sand dunes couldn't play a large portion of it, especially if they're reinforced. That doesn't mean that oyster reefs couldn't play a role if they're done properly. But I think relying upon wetlands, relying upon only sand dunes, relying upon only oyster reefs is not an effective solution, and potentially an area of false hope, I might add.
So if all the ducks were in order and we could start building this in a month, how long would it take to complete the barrier?
You know, that's an excellent question. I've seen varying estimates. Realistically, I think probably 2 or 3 years, and that's without a storm in between. But I would be remiss to say that I know exactly. That is beyond my scope.
It's interesting. If we could do it in 2 or 3 years, that's pretty impressive. And it what you're saying is there's a possibility that the time to construct is a lot longer than the time to decide.
The storm was 2008. This idea has been floated since 2009. We're on a 7-year frame here. So, if we had it in under 5, we'd be pretty close.
It would be doing well. I trust that you will keep your eye on it. Maybe we'll get back together and have another conversation as this develops. But I appreciate your spending the time with us today to bring us up to date on what's going on in the Galveston and Houston area. Thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you, Joe. Absolutely. Happy to discuss it.
All right. Good luck. Talk to you soon, I hope.
Thank you.